Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the war at least nearing an end, the world is sharply divided over who should administer post-war Iraq. For the United States, critical choices now loom about what kind of global power it now wants to be. Futures far beyond Baghdad hinge on the American decision tonight on Point. The U.S., the U.N., Iraq, and a global fork in the road. We begin with today's dramatic Kurdish homecoming in the northern Iraqi oil city of Kirkuk. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters streamed into Kirkuk this morning after 12 years of displacement under Saddam Hussein. Luke Harding, correspondent with The Guardian, went in with the Kurds. He spoke with us from the center of Kirkuk. I asked what he has seen today.
Well, it's been the most amazing day. I started off the morning sitting on a hill outside Kirkuk with Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and U.S. Special Forces. Really, it seemed like another day here. The Iraqi army, who were encamped about 3 or 4 kilometers away, were shelling. There were B-52s in the sky. There was bombing. And it looks as if, northern Iraq would carry on much as it's been over the past 3 weeks. And then suddenly, kind of mysteriously, about 12:30 Iraqi time, 1 o'clock, the mood just kind of flipped. And then suddenly, within minutes, a stream of Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and kind of battered Toyota pickup trucks and in taxis were surging towards Kirkuk, and we kind of joined them. And by early afternoon, had almost by accident liberated the city with absolutely no Iraqi resistance at all.
And tonight, you are sitting along with these Kurdish fighters in the very center of Kirkuk.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, what's astonishing, Tom, is the fact that there are no coalition troops here. Briefly earlier on this afternoon, I saw 3 Land Rovers full of U.S. Special Forces who'd gathered in the main square next to a statue of Saddam Hussein, which some views are trying to pull down. But apart from that, no, there are no American troops here. And what's more, over this last couple of hours, Kirkuk has been descending into more or less total anarchy with massive looting. I mean, I know we've seen looting before in Basra and Baghdad, but here it's been on a truly prodigious scale. And what's curious is it's been done largely by the Peshmerga. You know, the people who've liberated the city are now looting everything they can lay their hands on, from air conditioning units to bicycles. I even saw 3 Peshmerga driving away in a forklift truck.
What about the residents of Kirkuk who have been living there for so many years under the protection of Saddam Hussein? Are there revenge killings going on? What's happened to Saddam's military, to the Ba'ath Party, to the oil workers who were part of Saddam Hussein's society?
That's a very good question, Tom. I mean, the Iraqi army simply disappeared. It kind of melted away this morning. I think there was a small uprising here, and the Iraqi army retreated in the direction of Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's birthplace. Now, since then, I've been up to the Gurgur oil field, which is really Iraq's largest. It's this vast refinery complex on the outskirts of Kirkuk. And I drove in there early this afternoon, confidently expecting to find U.S. Special Forces manning it. There was no one there. It was astonishing. In fact, I found a whole load of Arab workers who had no idea that President Saddam had gone, believed his regime was still in power, and who didn't realize the city had fallen. It was completely surreal.
But the oil fields have not been fired. Are they burning? Are they out of control? Are they operating normally?
Well, they are burning. I mean, certainly one oil well has been spewing black smoke into the sky all day. Now, I talked to an oil worker who said it had been lit this morning. It's not clear who lit it or why they lit it, but it's billowing black smoke into the air. I mean, where I am sitting on my hotel balcony, I can smell it. It gets into your clothes, and you can feel it in your lungs. So one oil well is burning, but the rest of the main refinery complex seems to be intact, but bizarrely with no U.S. Special Forces there.
And what about the Kurdish fighters who have come in today? They took Kirkuk before in 1991 after the last Gulf War, got pushed back out, but this is a hometown for many of them. Yet they know the Turks are watching very anxiously from Turkey, saying this cannot fall into the hands of the Kurds. Do they feel it's theirs? It's the spoils of war for them now, or they're expecting to share it with Baghdad?
I think they absolutely do. And what was interesting today was that, you know, we're always told the Kurds are not going to be allowed to take these strategic northern cities. In fact, that's precisely what they've done. What they've done, apparently, it seems with the connivance of Washington, is they've waved a kind of giant V sign towards Turkey and Ankara. They've surged in here in large numbers. They've planted their flags in the center of the city. And this really is Turkey's nightmare scenario. This is a Kurdish city. This could be the capital of an independent Kurdish state. I don't think the Kurdish parties here see it like that. I mean, they don't want their own state. But they do feel they've come home. They feel the Peshmerga has come home. This is their city, and they're staying here.
Were they astonished today at how easy the last stretch into the center of this major oil center was?
Yeah, I think they were, but it was a kind of mad cavalcade. You know, I was sort of in it, and the Peshmerga was streaming down like a bunch of very excited kids, really. No one was firing at them. There was no resistance at all. The Iraqi army had gone, and certainly initially people were kind of waving very enthusiastically at them. And having kind of liberated the city, they you know, really, very, very swiftly, they moved on to the more serious business of looting, you know, and grabbing anything they could find.
And after a decade of Arabization, where Saddam Hussein was sending his own supporters into this city and evicting Kurds, do you already see signs of Kurds coming back to reclaim houses and homes, or are people expecting that will come?
Yeah, just very brief signs. And when I was leaving the oil field today, I noticed one villa, a rather nice villa next to a tennis court, which had already been occupied by a Kurd who'd moved back and who'd written his name, Ahmed, in huge black letters on the wall. So I think there's going to be a lot of reappropriation going on, a lot of people moving into homes that they've lost, or indeed moving into other people's homes over the next few days, which I think I can confidently predict are going to be absolutely chaotic.
But the main activity today, the looting of Kirkuk.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, Tom. Looting and liberation.
Looting and liberation, they seem to go together in the last few days. Luke Harding, thank you very much for joining us from the center of Kirkuk.
You're welcome.
Luke Harding is a correspondent with the Guardian newspaper. He spoke with us from Kirkuk, overtaken today by Kurds. With thin global support and much global dismay, America thumbed its nose at the United Nations last month and went to war with Iraq. Now Iraqis are dancing and looting in the streets, and the U.S.-UN question is back on the table. The immediate issue is who should administer post-war Iraq. Washington so far appears determined to control that task. The bigger question embedded in the Iraq issue is what kind of world America and its companions on the planet now want, unilateral or multilateral, a world of superpower edicts or supercharged debate. Do you want a world led by U.S. power or U.N. consensus? Should the U.S. welcome the U.N. back into a leading role or keep it firmly on the sidelines? What works here for the U.S., for the world, short-term, long-term? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Timothy Wirth, president of the United Nations Foundation and Better World Fund. He spent more than 20 years serving in the U.S. Congress, first as congressman and then as U.S. senator from Colorado. He's author of Does the United States Need the U.N., an article that appeared today in theglobalist.com. Good evening and welcome, Senator Wirth.
Good evening. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Jack, Timothy Wirth, we'll be joined in a moment by Stephen Schwartz, a sharp critic of the United Nations, particularly in rebuilding. But before we go there, Timothy Wirth, I want to turn to you. The issue of who administers this transitional period in Iraq is very much on the table, and right behind it is a great big headline in the Wall Street Journal said today, the bigger issue. America must decide, it says, what kind of power to be after Iraq war. And with that, in large degree, what kind of world we're going to have. Do you see us facing a kind of fork in the road about whether or not to re-embrace the UN as a lead institution or to go with the big power?
I think embracing the UN is a symptom of the larger question, which is the one that you referred to earlier that was in the journal today. We are on the threshold of, and I hope that America really engages in the debate as to what we want our foreign policy to be. We've traditionally had a cooperative, multilateral foreign policy that was focused on containment, essentially, and focused on trying to develop consensus around the world, particularly with our allies in Europe. That has been overtaken, beginning 10 years ago at the end of the first Bush administration, now continuing very aggressively with the so-called Bush Doctrine, which is we've seen now played out in Iraq, which is a very aggressive, essentially unilateral, but more importantly, I think, a doctrine of preemption, suggesting that, you know, we can and should move in this world of terrorism and this world of rogue states, perhaps on the edge of having weapons of mass destruction. We should and must act unilaterally. This is a very significant departure from what we've done in the past, and it is, you know, that is the fork in the road, and now, you know, we should be in the middle, and we're trying to encourage at the UN Foundation, we're trying to encourage this debate so that people really do become engaged.
Timothy Wirth, you write in theglobalist.com today, we may be tempted to act as if military superiority allows the United States to ignore the importance of engagement, traditional relationships, and leadership that stems from our commitment to unassailable universal values. But the real victim, you write, of this strategy in all likelihood is going to be the United States of America. And yet, as you write that, you know that there's a very active contrary school of thought right now that says getting into the whole nettle of the UN just muddies the waters and ends up with absolutely unacceptably muddy, unclear, vague, unbold scenarios for the future.
Well, I think, you know, politics domestically and politics globally is not neat. You don't put it on an organizational chart. It isn't particularly clear. It sometimes is muddy. But that's the process of trying to reach political consensus. And the question I think that we face, and, you know, obviously we come down very strongly on the side of the fact that you can't operate on military power alone, and nor can you do what has to be done around the world acting alone as a country. We need this kind of cooperative effort, complicated, difficult, muddy, and complex as it is. I think anybody who has watched the process of legislation being made in the United States Congress sort of recoils in many ways from what happens, but that is a participatory, largely very democratic process. You know, what kind of a process do we want to see around the world, or is it one that we are going to say we can impose with a few people, in fact, deciding that, or are we going to do it in a much more open and transparent way, one that I think is probably more responsive to the world of the 21st century?
But you know, there's such a strong school of thought now, very near the very center of power of the Bush administration, saying we can't run this big world by committee. We have to have bold, clear, strong leadership. And that view appears at the moment to be holding sway.
Well, I think that there's a very deep split in the Bush administration. The most powerful or the most aggressive member of the cabinet, the Secretary of Defense, clearly holds one perspective. Mm-hmm. And the most popular member of the cabinet, Secretary Powell, clearly holds a different perspective. I don't think that this issue has been resolved. I think there's been a lot more aggressive focus on one side of the debate, much less on the other. But I think as Americans sit back and think about this, that debate will occur. I was struck during the time leading up to the war by a few statements that came out of the United States Senate, and there was precious small debate. But the very forceful articulation of the need to have this debate coming particularly from Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia, who said, where is the Senate at this time? Where is this debate? We are on the verge of some very, very important long-term decisions, and this has got to be aired, got to be discussed, got to be understood. We cannot let ourselves get carried away with the focus of the moment. We can't let ourselves get carried away. I don't think we don't want to. With a sense of triumphalism now, we've got to be very careful about how we do this. The long-term implications are very significant.
Jack Beatty, it looks to me so far as if that debate has moved right out of the debating society and onto the battlefield. I mean, it's being settled with boots on the ground.
I think that's right. But, you know, legitimacy does not come out of the barrel of a gun. It's a matter of consent. It's a matter of other people agreeing that what you're doing is legitimate. And like it or not, one of the realities of our planet is that, especially for countries in the third world, especially for countries in the Arab world, the UN confers legitimacy. And why, after all, was Tony Blair so willing to go to such lengths to get that second UN resolution? It was because in front of what Jonathan Schell calls the other superpower, international opinion, mm-hmm. he recognized that we needed that imprimatur. Now, if we don't, we had to jump over that in order to get this war. Although we did get the first resolution, so we played at least partly on the UN grounds. But now we desperately need to get that legitimation for the occupation. and for what comes. Not because it would simply be the right thing to do, but because it would be prudent. It would make what we do seem acceptable to the other superpower.
We are talking tonight about the U.S., the U.N., the future of Iraq, and a global fork in the road. Whether the world goes unilateral or multilateral, goes with law or goes with power, what do you think? Do you want a world led by power or by consensus? And did the debate over the war on Iraq prove to be the UN to be ineffective or America to be bullying? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S., the U.N., the future of Iraq, and a global fork in the road. What's your vision? A world led by law or a world led by power? And is the U.N. a multilateral, is its multilateral dream a mirage? Or is U.S. domination a recipe for success or resentment and disaster? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight has been Senator Timothy Wirth, former U.S. Senator from Colorado, now President of the United Nations Foundation and the Better World Fund. We're joined now by Stephen Schwartz. He joins us from Washington. He's Director of the Islam and Democracy Program at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's author of UN Go Home, an article in this week's The Weekly Standard. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Schwartz.
Thank you.
Stephen Schwartz, I want to look first at the particular and then pull back to look at the big issue of how much the U.S. and the world should be leaning on power or the U.N. At this point. You write in the Weekly Standard about the experience of Kosovo being administered by the United Nations after the conflict there. You end a big substantial critique of that U.N. rebuilding process with a quote from a Kosovar journalist who says, if the Iraqi people have to undergo anything like what we have in Kosovo, God help them. Why?
Well, the bottom line is the United Nations did not support the intervention in Kosovo. The United Nations played a criminal role in Bosnia, essentially assisting the Serbs to murder 250,000 people.
A criminal role? You're going to have to clarify that.
A criminal role. The United Nations went into Bosnia with their blue-helmeted troops, claiming that they were going to separate the two sides, and they were going to bring peace to the country. They did not do that. They essentially oversaw the continuing Serbian attempt at genocide until the United States went in and stopped the Serbian attempt at genocide.
So there was not bold intervention from the UN, you're saying?
Pardon me?
There was not bold intervention there.
Yeah, there was intervention to help the Serbs.
Mm.
A man named Yasushi Akashi, who as far as I'm concerned belongs at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, who was the head of the United Nations High Commissioner's Office for Refugees, went into Bosnia and said he didn't know who was besieging Sarajevo. And the role of the UN was to, in essence, assist the Serbs in murdering 250,000 people.
Take us to the other side of that great long chapter in the Kosovar rebuilding. You're saying it hasn't worked out under the UN.
Well, my point is this. The United Nations did not support the intervention in Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mistake for the Clinton administration to think that since they hadn't supported the intervention, that they should then be given the concession of control over the aftermath of reconstruction.
And what went wrong with that reconstruction, in your view, Stephen?
Well, 4 years after the end of the bombing by NATO, Kosovars, both Albanian Serbs and the minorities, have only 4 hours of electric power at a time. There has essentially been no reconstruction of the economy. There is not anything that could be remotely called the construction of a real economy in Kosovo or a stable society in Kosovo.
And you take from that the UN should not be put in charge of administering a post-war Iraq. But what about then the much larger question, even Stephen Schwartz, about general world leadership? Should it be centered in the United Nations or should it be centered in Washington?
I think the United Nations has gone the way of the League of Nations, and the United Nations has essentially failed. I don't think it's a question of centering it in Washington. I think it's a question of centering in these countries.
In which countries, Stephen?
The countries where these processes take place, like Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
South Korea created a prosperous, stable, democratic society. The United States provided an umbrella of security over South Korea, and South Korea essentially did it on their own.
Well, to say the least, I mean, it provided tens of thousands of troops on their soil and a very, very strong hand involved in South Korea.
There was no hand. I've been in South Korea a lot.
I've spent years in South Korea. There's plenty of U.S. hand in South Korea.
Hold on. There's no U.S. role in writing the Constitution or setting up political parties or setting up newspapers or running the health system. All there is in South Korea is the presence of U.S. troops to prevent a North Korean invasion.
Well, that's a debate we'll set aside. I would say there are many years where there was a strong imprint. But your point is that you're saying let these countries go and rebuild themselves with support.
Another example is Indonesia. Indonesia had never been a democracy. Indonesia had gone from Dutch imperialism to Japanese imperialism, to Sukarno, who was a semi-dictator, to Suharto, who was quite a brutal fascist dictator. Mm. Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world. They have oil. They also have ethnic and religious diversity issues. They were able to come out of the dictatorship and create a stable democracy with no interference by foreigners whatever.
Timothy Wirth, what do you take from the examples that Stephen Schwartz is throwing out, in particular the Kosovo example, where he says the UN resisted intervention, and then when it got involved post-war, it has failed?
Well, I think that there's a lot of very, very loose language being thrown around and dots not connected about the UN playing a criminal role and assisting the Serbs in
killing.
This is just so over the top. It's just very hard to understand what's being said here. Mm. The basic fact of the matter is that if we look where we're going in Iraq, is that there are a number of missions that have to be undertaken. Nobody is suggesting that the UN by itself is going to be the rebuilder. The question in front of us, and the U.S. and the U.K. are going to provide the security. They're the people that can do that, and without security, we can't get anywhere. There are a number of questions. Who is going to engage in, initially, the humanitarian relief? Now, can the U.S. do that by itself with our military? No. It must engage the international agencies to do that job.
They don't have
the
to
Iraqis
be the United
can't
Nations.
Do that. The Iraqis can't do that for themselves. They're on their back in need of food and water, and the idea of saying, well, let these countries do it for themselves, well, there's going to have to be a quite significant humanitarian engagement, and I believe that has to come from the international agencies. We then get to the point of starting to think about putting together a civil administration. And as suggested earlier, you know, the legitimacy that comes from a cooperative international effort is one that's going to be absolutely important. It's so important. I cannot imagine, if we go to the most recent example in Afghanistan, I cannot imagine that the U.S. by itself could have pulled together this fledgling democratic effort to bring all of the factions of Afghanistan together. That was done through the U.N. auspices, through very carefully working those politics, getting people to work together. The U.S. again provided the security elements, but it was the international community that provided the legitimacy and the capacity to come together.
But Senator Wirth,
it's not an either-or sharply defined situation.
But what we're hearing from the administration in Washington is, despite George Bush talking about a vital role for the UN, everything indicated by action seems to be excluding the UN from that legitimizing role, unless you know something that we don't at this point.
Well,
One moment, please, Stephen.
I don't think this has played itself out yet. Mm-hmm. I think that clearly, you know, the president had gone to talk to Tony Blair. The Europeans, the French and the British are now coming very closely together. The Europeans are making it very clear that this broader cooperative legitimization is going to be absolutely essential. And I don't think that the jury is not in yet on this.
But they Jay Garner's crew is already moving into Umkasar and presumably soon to Baghdad. I mean, isn't it almost a fait accompli?
Well, I think, the U.S. has to provide the security elements in this. There's no debate about that whatsoever. And without the kind of security arrangements, nothing else can be done. So, I mean, we watched today, you know, both the victory and the extraordinary change of government. But we also see the potential chaos that follows on. So first and foremost, there has to be a security outline. Then we can think about the humanitarian assistance, which has got to be done in very close cooperation and probably under the auspices of the international community. And then we start to get to the next questions of civil administration, how you deal with the oil question, and then long-term, how you deal with the political process.
Senator Wirth is essentially filibustering here, and I'd like to be able to respond.
Stephen Schwartz, come on in.
I'd like to respond here. I resent it when I go on these programs and one person dominates the whole program.
Well, we're welcoming you,
Stephen
Schwartz.
Some of the comments that were made. First of all, there are very efficient organizations like Catholic Relief Services, Islamic charities based in countries like Malaysia that are not extremist Islamic charities. There are even Protestant charities that do not engage in proselytism that can do the basic relief work having to do with food.
You're suggesting these as an alternative to the United Nations?
I most certainly am.
Why?
Furthermore, there are three things that people are not looking at here. One is the French should play no role in this at all, because the French have shown that they cannot be trusted to act correctly in any Muslim country. They are viciously anti-Islamic. They showed this in Bosnia. They showed this in Kosovo, where they would do nothing to protect the local population. And I don't believe that the French should be allowed anywhere inside Iraq at all.
But what about the United Nations in total?
Secondly, there is the presumption that Russia would be involved in this through the United Nations. I have something to inform your listeners about that most Westerners are not aware of. The entire Islamic world views Russia, because of Chechnya, as in many respects much more of an enemy of Islam and Muslims than the United States. Furthermore, Russia assisted the Saddam regime to remain in power.
And Stephen Schwartz, what about this issue of
model based on success?
What about this issue of legitimacy?
You're wrong about legitimacy. The idea that the United
I'm wrong. I'm asking you.
Confers legitimacy is ridiculous. How does the United Nations confer legitimacy when it has essentially failed to change the situation in Kashmir, has kept the Palestinians in a situation of dependency, has played a criminal role, and it did play a criminal role, and I was there and I saw it, and I can work as a human rights investigator, and I can cite you chapter and verse on the criminal role of the United
Nations. We're not going down that road, but I take your point.
You're wrong about legitimacy. The United Nations does not have legitimacy in the Muslim world.
Jack Beatty, come in here. There's such polar views, and it's hard to keep them all in mind at once, but they do represent, I think, the kind of poles of the debate that's very much out there in the world right now.
Yes, I just don't. I mean, it seems to me that if people say things from different parts of the world, one gives them the benefit of the doubt. They know what they mean. And what we hear from the British, what we hear from Arab governments, what we heard in the run-up in the debate around the intervention was legitimacy in the world, not in Mr. Schwartz's world, but in the world, is conferred by United Nations a participation by United Nations approval, that this is one of the ways in which the United States of America has for a long time got its way in the world by saying, well, look, we're just not out here being imperialists. We're acting with and for a community of nations. And this has been very valuable to us. And it can be now, in this current instance, through the sorts of things that Senator Wirth was talking about, the kinds of cooperative relationships we can work out, it could be of great value to us again in taking off that taint of imperialism and colonialism and saying to the world, we are what we say we are. We're not out to colonize these people. We're not out to take their oil. This is going to be handled by the UN.
Oh, yeah, look. Right, the UN. The UN, which imposed the sanctions. The UN, which basically helped keep Saddam in power.
Stephen Schwartz, Timothy Wirth, Jack, please stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us, and I want to invite them in. Tom's calling from Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a really interesting debate. Mr. Schwartz gets right in there. Mr. Beatty, I've been a subscriber to your magazine for a long time. I agree with you in the sense that we cannot go this alone, but I really have to look at the UN as it is and ask the question, where would we be if the UN had been allowed to do what it would have done, which is basically nothing at all?
With Iraq, you mean, Tom?
With regard to Iraq, we would not be there. Another issue.
There was weapons inspection going on. Is that nothing at all in your mind?
Well, I can remember the time when my opinion changed. I was going down an elevator and saw these little blipverts that basically said that France would not accept Britain's series of steps that would lay some conditions on Iraq that would allow them to meet those conditions because it might lead to war. And I smacked myself in the head and said, of course it's going to lead to war. That's the entire point, because Saddam Hussein will not be moved by anything but force.
So, Tom, are you all done with the United Nations? Can the world work without it?
No, no. Let's back off for one second, too. Mm-hmm. You're framing the question in a manner that says, is it Washington or is it the UN? And I don't think that's the question at all. Does the UN want to play a part, or do we have to find other coalitions? Obviously, it's going to have to be international. No country ought to run the world. I don't want to be in the country that runs the world. I think that's ridiculous. But if the UN is going to stand up and say no, no, no to every point at which we say yes, 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 then there's nothing to work with.
Tom, thanks for your call. Timothy Wirth, what about it? Is there an alternative to the UN, or is this what we've got to work with?
Oh, I think this is what we've got to work with, and, you know, with the UN, and we've got a European community to work with, and, you know, there is clearly a burgeoning or a potentially emerging coalition in the Arab world, which we've always hoped would emerge. The suggestion that the UN was doing nothing in Iraq is just false. The inspectors from 1991 to 1996 were extraordinarily effective.
The inspectors are not the issue.
In terms of the discovery of the chemical capabilities, finding out that there was an emerging biological capability and a nuclear capability. After 1996, unfortunately, the consensus to allow that, the inspectors continued to stop. But that's a good example of where when, you know, given the authority from the Security Council, and that's the nature of the way in which that process works, the UN was a very effective one.
Let me bring something up.
Stephen Schwartz.
The UN Security Council never, in either of the debates on the resolutions, addressed issues of human rights in Iraq. You know, you have two guys on this show who are essentially saying that we are supposed to, having done what we did, we should now go crawling back to France and Germany and the United Nations, who didn't support what we did, and beg them for help.
But Stephen Schwartz, what's the long-term alternative to having that working international community?
The alternative is a model based on the experiences of the new democracies in the world, like South Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, Poland, Hungary, Slovenia, places where the United Nations did not play a role and which managed to become stable, democratic, prosperous countries without the meddling of this business, because it's not an international organization. Mm. It's a business in a building in New York.
So are you saying the United States would call the big tune and shell out all the dollars
that
for these companies? Well, I'm asking.
No. And stop trying to put words in my mouth and stop trying to turn me into an imperialist. I'm saying Poland called the tune, Hungary called the tune, Indonesia called the tune, Taiwan called the tune, South Korea called the tune. And let me point something out that Mr. Wolfowitz pointed out. When we say that we're helping these countries get to democracy, it doesn't mean that we're helping them become our puppets. We are defending democracy in Turkey, even though Turkey would not support us in Iraq. We are defending democracy in South Korea, even though South Korea is now critical of us on the North Korea issue. When the Philippines, when we assisted the Filipinos in getting rid of Marcos, the first thing they did is turn around and tell us to take our bases and leave.
And we did.
Well, it's not a matter of imperialism and colonialism. It's a matter of ending the imperialism and colonialism. And the fact is, the United Nations, which is essentially a business run by a bunch of tyrannical regimes, a bunch of dictatorships, Kofi Annan, let me remind you, was appointed in the UN at a time when Ghana was not a democracy, when Ghana was a dictatorship. It's essentially a so-called organization that is top-heavy with dictatorships, in which a country like Russia, which is one of the worst anti-Islamic countries in the world, anti-Islamic regimes in the world, has a veto, in which China, which is nothing like a democracy, has a veto, in which France, which is viewed as an enemy of Islam, has a veto.
Stephen Schwartz, we've got it. Let me get Timothy Worth's response.
Well, top-heavy with dictatorships, it seems to me, is a remarkable accusation, you know, of the UK and of France, the other two very clear democracies on the Security Council, Russia, an emerging democracy, and China, which is making a transition of an extraordinary fashion. I mean, and to say that these are tyrannical regimes running the UN, you know, is just preposterous. To say that we're in a situation where, you know, South Korea emerged by itself. I mean, you know, how did that happen? It happened because there was a UN coalition that started in 1950, battling the incursions from the north.
From the beginning. We've got to take a short break here, Timothy Wirth. Please stand by. Stephen Schwartz, thank you for joining us. Stephen Schwartz is author of UN Go Home, an article in this week's Weekly Standard. We're talking about the U.S., the UN, the future of Iraq, and a global fork in the road. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S., the U.N., the future of Iraq, and a global fork in the road. You can join the conversation. Do you want a world led by U.S. power or by U.N. consensus? And does a U.N.-led world end up timid and paralyzed? Does a U.S.-led world end up boldly free or too often at war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Senator Timothy Wirth, former U.S. Senator Timothy Wirth, currently president of the United Nations Foundation and the Better World Fund. He's author of Does the United States Need the UN? An article that appeared in today's globalist.com. And right now we're joined by Patricia calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Patricia. You're on the air.
Hello. I don't think there's really any question at all but that we must stay with the UN, the time for warfare and imperialism is definitely over, unless we want to blow ourselves to kingdom come. I also would like to suggest that we empower the UN by utilizing something they once had called the International Court of Justice, about which I've heard nothing except that a criminal court was set up within this International Court of Justice. Why haven't we used the International Court of Justice?
So you're saying use the UN and give it more teeth.
Exactly. It was set up with an International Court of Justice. We have never utilized it.
Well, the U.S. has actively walked away from that kind of thing recently. Patricia, thank you for your call. Timothy Worth, you write today, looking at Patricia's first comment there, that the United States, you say, the United Nations faces potential destabilization at this moment as a result of unrelenting U.S. pressure. That sounds like pretty serious stuff.
Well, I think that we have one side of the U.S. administration, and again, I don't think the decision's made within the administration, but one side, you know, is pushing very, very hard for not only minimizing the role, but there are a number of, very aggressive individuals who really want us to take the position of leaving the U.N., and that's been around for a long time, and I think that these people now have a certain sense of achievement from what's going on in Iraq, and the next steps, I think, are quite alarming. I think going back to we have for 55 years been the primary champion of and were the architect of the United Nations and, you know, this process of engaging nations of all kinds. It's awkward, difficult, certainly imperfect, but it's the only thing that we've got in this fashion, and we ought to be using it, as was suggested earlier, I think, by Jack, that we ought to be doing or by that we ought to be doing this in a much more careful way to engage all of these countries for the purpose of legitimacy.
And what about Stephen Schwartz's critique that UN decisions, in his view, too often end up, or the thrust of the UN ends up anti-democratic?
Well, I just don't think that that's the case. I mean, there are certain things about the parts of the UN. There are certain individual countries in the UN that you might not agree with. You know, but overall, the ability of the UN to undertake some very difficult issues, you know, establishing a global commitment for human rights, establishing a capacity to think about global transnational environmental problems, to talk about the, as they did at the Cairo program, at the Cairo conference in 1994, about the empowerment of women and the much more broader engagement of women. These are the establishment of a set of norms and standards that the world slowly but surely comes to agree with.
And what about Patricia's – I'm sorry, Senator. What about Patricia's comment that she'd like to see the International Court of Justice held up high? The U.S. has been, of course, extremely reluctant to get anywhere near having to bow to U.N. rulings like that. The black helicopter, you know, brigade sees all kinds of end of sovereignty there. Is that opposition to this gaining ground with the momentum you described among the group that doesn't want to really be involved with the U.N. at all?
Well, we have certainly shut out the idea of the International Criminal Court. The administration has refused to become engaged in that, and our previous administration, the Clinton administration, was, you know, a reluctant supporter of it. There is an international court now in The Hague. It is, doing a lot of extremely important international contractual work and border work and that sort of thing. To get to a court of justice, to get to a criminal court, is a next step that has to be done. Special tribunals were set up, for example, following Yugoslavia. That's where Milosevic is right now. The UN has been, you know, very helpful in engaging in the process in Rwanda of trying to develop a process of justice there, taken very long, very hard to do. But those processes are underway. And, you know, the UN has been behind getting that done.
Jack Beatty, please.
Yeah, caller Tom asked me about he gave his reaction to how the French and Germans were acting and just basically saying that they wouldn't go to war over anything, even though they had signed the first resolution that would seem to have committed them to that. And I think he's right about that. I mean, I think we really did see a part of the UN that was kind of ugly, but we saw it on all sides. We saw a German chancellor who saved his skin by being able to run an election against the United States. Mm-hmm. We saw a French president who saw a chance to change the subject from his scandals in France to you know, I'm a world leader by defying the U.S. But we also saw a U.S. president who was saying, oh, yes, we're going to do the inspections, and yes, we're going to go ahead with all this, and we're going to, while building up constantly toward war and while really not taking the inspections all that seriously. So we saw everybody, sort of all these separate countries using this universalist institution for their national interests rather than in any way of collective security. And I think that's the grave disappointment of the UN. It is not an instrument of collective security, because it is pooled sovereignties, and at points like this, you see each country acting out of its own interest. I guess the question for Tom would be, are we more secure? I mean, yes, if the French had their way, the Iraqis would not be liberated. But on the other hand, you have to ask yourself, would American security be stronger or weaker? That is to say, are we stronger by this action, or has this, as Senator Graham of Florida thinks, weakened us because exposed us to more terrorism?
And Timothy Worth, you write that far from nuancing its rhetoric, the Bush administration keeps ratcheting up statements that act to undermine the institution that America needs most. Where do you think this is headed, Timothy Worth? You're watching it as closely as anyone.
I don't think that's been resolved. I think that, again, you have this very sharp split within the administration, and the president has not come down yet, I don't think, on how he wants the administration to behave in this. I think that he's going to also be looking at public opinion polls, which are resoundingly in support of the United Nations and a sharing of the burden. I mean, just overwhelmingly, 3-4-1, and there's an election coming up. He's looking down the line. I think most Americans want this burden to be shared. The UN, in so many ways, is the logical place for sharing that burden in humanitarian assistance and in beginning of civil administration and the political process.
Timothy Worth, what's your guess in this century that we've just entered? Does the world go more democratic and consensus oriented, or more power oriented?
Well, no, I think we're going to end up going in the consensus way with the United States, understanding that it's in its best interest to have the UN on our side, working very carefully with us. We're the major player in the UN. The UN contributes very significantly to our own national interests. So that's where we'll come out.
And in the Iraq decision, if the UN is not involved at the heart of the administration there in transition, is that a significant U.S. step away from commitment to the UN?
Oh, I think it is, but I don't think that will happen. I think that, we will see in 2 months, 3 months, 5 months, as we get deeply engaged in this, that the legitimacy that was, suggested earlier by Jack is absolutely imperative. And, we're going to be looking for that, searching for that. The pressure is going to be on us to do that. And the American public is going to say, hey, wait a minute, we want to share this burden. We want to get our troops out of there as rapidly as we possibly can. We don't want to be the peacekeeper. We don't want to appear to be, as Jack Kemp said the other day, the Raj, the empire. And so I think those pressures are going to work themselves out, particularly as we move toward the election in 2004.
Timothy Worth, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Timothy Worth is president of the United Nations Foundation. He was senator from Colorado. He's author of Does the United States Need the UN? In today's globalist.com. Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to listen to a bit of tape with you. Earlier today, President Bush and Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair addressed the Iraqi people on the same Baghdad television channel that was carrying Saddam Hussein's messages just last week. The remarks, which were broadcast in English with Arabic subtitles, were taped Tuesday when the two leaders met in Belfast. Here is what President Bush had to say to the Iraqi people.
This is George W. Bush, the President of the United States. At this moment, the regime of Saddam Hussein is being removed from power, and a long era of fear and cruelty is ending. American and coalition forces are now operating inside Baghdad, and we will not stop until Saddam's corrupt gang is gone. The government of Iraq and the future of your country will soon belong to you. The goals of our coalition are clear and limited. We will end a brutal regime whose aggression and weapons of mass destruction make it a unique threat to the world. Coalition forces will help maintain law and order so that Iraqis can live in security. We will respect your great religious traditions, whose principles of equality and compassion are essential to Iraq's future. We will help you build a peaceful and representative government that protects the rights of all citizens. And then, our military forces will leave. Iraq will go forward as a unified, independent, and sovereign nation that has regained a respected place in the world. The United States and its coalition partners respect the people of Iraq. We are taking unprecedented measures to spare the lives of innocent Iraqi citizens. We are beginning to deliver food and water and medicine to those in need. Our only enemy is Saddam and his brutal regime. And that regime is your enemy as well. In the new era that is coming to Iraq, your country will no longer be held captive to the will of a cruel dictator. You will be free, free to build a better life instead of building more palaces for Saddam and his sons, free to pursue economic prosperity without the hardship of economic sanctions, free to travel and free to speak your mind, free to join in the political affairs of Iraq. And all the people who make up your country, Kurds, Shia, Turkmens, Sunnis, and others, will be free of the terrible persecution that so many have endured. The nightmare that Saddam Hussein has brought to your nation will soon be over. You are a good and gifted people, the heirs of a great civilization that contributes to all humanity. You deserve better than tyranny and corruption and torture chambers. You deserve to live as free people. And I assure every citizen of Iraq, your nation will soon be free. Thank you.
President Bush addressing the Iraqi people on what used to be Iraqi state-run television earlier today. Here is just a bit of Tony Blair on that same broadcast.
We did not want this war. But in refusing to give up his weapons of mass destruction, Saddam gave us no choice but to act. Now that the war has begun, it will be seen through to the end. We will continue to do all we can to avoid civilian casualties. Our enemy is Saddam and his regime, not the Iraqi people. Our forces are friends and liberators of the Iraqi people, not your conquerors. And they will not stay in Iraq a day longer than is necessary.
Tony Blair on Iraqi television today. Jack Beatty, two incredibly remarkable addresses in English, Arabic subtitles. The leaders of the United States and Great Britain speaking directly now to the people of Iraq.
Yes, I think there's some practical questions, whether they'll be able to see it, whether the televisions are working and so on. But maybe this is why they let the signal on for as long as they did.
But no electricity in Basra, we just heard tonight, so not much viewership there.
Yes, the president is right. The fear and cruelty of Saddam is gone. These people are freer. He did mention we're going to be searching for weapons of mass destruction, and of course that remains to be seen whether we'll find any. But, you know, one of the questions about this war is, will the American people be freer? That is to say, will our freedom from fear grow or decline because of this war? And that's one of the juries that's out, it seems to me. The other one is, and I think there's a time for them to do this. In Afghanistan, they refused to pay compensation for civilians killed and injured. Mm. And wouldn't it be a handsome gesture if the president were to say, you know, not only do we want to have you have a freer life, but we want to take the people who were tragically the victims of our effort, who paid the price for getting rid of your government. We want to compensate them insofar as we can. It may cost us $1 billion or so, but we think that's well spent. And it can never bring back, of course, the arms, the legs, the parents, but it's a gesture. Wouldn't that be something?
Well, $70 billion and counting, what's another billion? And it would be quite a gesture. Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, earlier today, we spoke with Drew Brown, a correspondent for Knight Ridder, embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division. To listen to his description of the aftermath of the liberation in Baghdad, go to our website at onpointradio.org. It was quite a day for Drew Brown, and you'll hear it in his voice there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.